Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose valiant efforts in the front lines of that war for many years, specifically on a very important battlefront, namely the effort to control who is coming into this country, who they are, why they're coming, how they're getting here, and what they do once they're here, is a dear friend and valued colleague by the name of Rosemary Jenks. She is the Director of Government Relations for an organization that has been simply indispensable for, well, quite some time now. The Numbers USA is its name, and you can find out much more about it at numbersusa.com. Rosemary, it's so good to talk to you. Welcome back. We haven't spoken, I think, since the pandemic struck. I'm very interested in your thoughts about whether, as seems to be the case, countries around the world, including our own, are taking much more thoughtfully and seriously the imperative need for border security and other immigration controls.
I think that, yes, we are certainly seeing signs that the administration is taking border security very seriously. They are trying to close down the southern border and the northern border. But I think we're still getting mixed messages on other flows of people into the United States, particularly workers, and especially low-skilled workers. The president, in one of his press conferences in the last couple of days, said that we need to keep the flow of H-2A agricultural workers coming.
Because without them, there won't be farms, I think he actually said once or twice. So he's stressing that. Is that right?
It is not right. I mean, there is no question that the agricultural industry relies heavily on foreign labor. A lot of their labor is illegal, and so those folks are already in the United States. The H-2As come in each year to do the agricultural work and then go home. So what the president is talking about, yes, is essentially having a flow of people coming across our borders legally, despite the fact that they're coming from countries that have coronavirus, and without testing them. And that is a huge problem because, you know, we've got enough problems of our own right now. We don't need to be paying for the medical care of foreign workers who come in, take American jobs, and then get sick. And the same thing goes with, you know, even the screening that they've been doing at ports and at airports is essentially temperature checking. Well, you know, that tells you only if you are symptomatic today. It doesn't tell you whether you're going to catch the virus tomorrow or if you already have it and just aren't showing symptoms. So, you know, we need to be doing antibody tests before anyone is admitted to the United States because that tells us that they have already had the disease. They're now immune to it, everyone says. And so they're not going to be carriers or victims of it.
This seems eminently sensible. I was wondering, do we have the capability to do that if the policy were adopted to try to restrict the flow of people who might be bringing it in?
We should have the capability soon, but you know, the first priority has to be doing the tests for our medical professionals, our healthcare workers. They have to be first priority. So until they're all tested, we should have completely closed borders. I mean, unless you're a citizen or a lawful permanent resident, you should not be coming into this country right now, period.
Speak to something else that you often mention in these contexts, Rosemary Jenks, and that is the fact that when you have unemployment spiking as it is at the moment, presumably there would be people willing to do what I've been told is something like 10% of these jobs who might not otherwise be, just in order to be gainfully employed in a difficult time. Your thoughts?
You know, it's interesting because, of course, the stimulus package that Congress passed, the latest one, increases unemployment benefits and gives you basically your full salary plus $600 a month. So, you know, you're better off going on unemployment. It's kind of insane. But the thing is, once this pandemic passes, we are going to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Americans who need jobs. And right now, the landscaping industry, the, you know, resort industry, all of these industries that are essentially out of work right now are still lobbying Congress for more foreign workers. It's insane. And if the administration goes along with that, then, you know, we will be prioritizing foreign workers over putting Americans back to work. And that cannot happen. We cannot let that happen.
Well, Numbers USA does a fantastic job of making the case for American workers and American vital interests, and I know that you'll be hard at that. Let me ask you about one other thing. Your president, Roy Beck, wrote a piece recently at numbersusa.com about the, well, effectively, the plundering, I guess one might say, of foreign medical personnel, doctors and nurses from countries that desperately need their talents to staff up our medical system. Talk about that as a challenge and what it means for both those countries and ours.
Yeah, well, it's typically called a brain drain when a country takes the skilled workers from another country. And there's no question. I mean, there's a nursing shortage in the Philippines because we have brought so many Filipino nurses here. But the other side of that is we have American graduates of medical school who are unable to get residency positions because they're going to foreign graduates. So, you know, that's a huge problem. We have to be placing our own American medical school graduates into those positions first. You know, and we have to be careful about the impact we're having on the foreign countries. But we also really need to be concerned about the impact that we're having on medical students from America. Because, I mean, imagine how much money they have paid. They've gone into debt to get this degree, and yet they're blocked from getting into an actual hospital position because of competition with foreign workers. So it is a problem.
And is it the case that those foreign workers are more qualified or better trained or more skilled than our medical personnel would be? Or is it, again, just as is so often the case, a question of whether the employers can get away with paying the foreign workers less?
It is often that they can get away with paying foreign workers less. It's also often that the foreign workers are more willing to go to rural areas that are underserved. They get special subsidies if they do that. They get to extend their visas if they do that. So that is an issue. But, you know, we've got to figure out ways to get Americans into these jobs when they have the training. And a lot of times the foreign workers actually graduate from the same universities that the Americans are graduating from in the United States. So it's not a skill problem. It's an incentives problem.
It is indeed. Well, the incentives have to be fixed. You're on the case, Rosemary Jenks at Numbers USA. We are so grateful to you for the work you do, as well as for your visits with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with updates, particularly in the midst of this crisis. Next up, we'll speak with Stephen Mosier about China's ambitions and their contribution to the crisis afflicting us at the moment, the coronavirus and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It is a pleasure to say, joined by a man I've come to admire greatly, in part through our service together on the Committee on the Present Danger, China, but mostly because long before that committee was formed, and certainly long before most of us were paying much attention to China, Stephen Mosier was doing that, and doing it with great effect. He wrote in 2002 a really important book, Hegemon, China's Plan to Dominate the Earth. He's followed it up in 2017 with Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is a New Threat to World Order. He has written a number of others. He has contributed mightily to the public policy debate, among other things, through his platform as the president of the Population Research Institute, and we're really grateful to him for taking a few minutes to talk with us today. Steve Mosher, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm particularly anxious to talk with you about your insights into what has befallen us through the Chinese Communist Party virus, as I think of it. But before we turn to that, Steve, just a quick word about the larger agenda that the Chinese Communist Party has had for many years, as you've documented in your books.
Well, no one should be surprised that the biggest killing machine on the planet, which is the Chinese Communist Party, should bring us the CCP virus. I mean, these are the same wonderful folks who gave China the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, Tiananmen Square, the one-child policy. The Wuhan virus, the CCP virus, if you want to call it that, is nothing new. This is a regime that's been sacrificing innocence to its ideology for over 70 years for, you know, its sheer power politics, first, last, and always. And the ultimate goal, of course, is not just to dominate the Chinese people. They've already done that for 70 years. It's to dominate the wider world. It's to spread its power, its control, its ideology to other parts of the world. And one thing we cannot let happen, Frank, is we cannot let in the aftermath of this pandemic, the origin of which is on China, the spread of which is on China, we cannot let China come out of this stronger and America weaker. And that is exactly the goal of the Chinese Communist Party, to use their $3 trillion in hard currency, to buy up Western companies for pennies on the dollar, to strengthen their hold over countries on the New Silk Road, to spread their version of the New World Order everywhere and always. That can't be the result of this.
Amen. Steve, let me drill down on a couple of things that you've said. One is, I'm afraid you're referring to the $3 trillion in hard currency reserves. They have proven to be very reluctant to tap that in our experience. But what they've got instead, which enables them to refrain from mostly using those dollars and euros and so on, is that they can get more money from our capital markets at will. And by some estimates, they're looking to get another $3 to $5 trillion on top of the $3 trillion that they've already managed to secure to this point. So that's a huge amount of walking around money for the advance of this very dangerous agenda. But Steve, specifically on this question of biological warfare, you and Tom Cotton have called attention to the fact that there is, of course, a Chinese Communist Party illegal covert biological weapons program. What reason do you think there is to believe this virus may have something to do with that program?
Well, we know because there are mentions of it in countless publications written by Chinese researchers, that China over the last 15 years has collected as many new viruses, including 300 new coronaviruses, has collected over 2,000 new viruses from wild animals. That actually is as many known viruses as the entire world collected in the previous 200 years. We had about 2,200 known viruses, and then the Chinese 15 years ago went into this frenzy, this absolute frenzy of collecting hundreds of new viruses, and now they've doubled the number of known viruses. Where do they get the coronaviruses from? Well, they get the coronaviruses largely from bats. And they've been collecting bats. They've been going to bat caves in Western China. In fact, there's a bat hunter, a bat man, as he's known in China, by the name of Mr. Tian, who has collected thousands of bats from caves in Western Hubei province, which, of course, is the province that was the epicenter of the epidemic. Those bats, along with their urine and their blood and their feces, are brought to two biolabs in Wuhan. One is the Institute of Virology. The other is the China's Center for Disease Control. And there they do research to isolate these new coronaviruses. Frank, in 2013, in Nature magazine, they published an article showing that some of these bat coronaviruses could directly infect human beings. You don't have to genetically engineer them. You don't have to insert links to make them infect human beings. They can directly infect human beings. And what we now think happened is one of the researchers, in fact, we know her name, Wang Yanling, was infected when she was working with these dangerous pathogens, these bat coronaviruses. She died, spread it to her colleagues, spread it to the Wuhan seafood market, which was only 280 meters away. That's only about 300 feet. And from there, it spread to the population. Now, think about this, Frank. If those bats and their dangerous coronaviruses had been left alone in their caves 600 miles from Wuhan, they would never have infected humanity. But they weren't. They were brought into a lab, and through careless lab procedure, while they're doing all this research, they allowed it to escape. The lab is in the center of a city of 12 million people. And from there, the ineptitude, the evil of the incompetence of the Chinese Communist Party let it spread throughout the world. And that's the origin and the epidemic that we are now dealing with. China has to pay a price for this. There must be a reckoning. This is all on the Communist Party from the beginning.
I know at American Greatness, you have emphasized the imperative need for the Chinese Communist Party to come clean on these kinds of facilities and the work that they're doing. There is, of course, concern that this is not just a scientific interest in virus collection. It is the weaponization of viruses as well. And there's a report that J.R. Nyquist published at the Epoch Times about 2 months ago that I'm sure you've seen, Steve Mosher, in which he quotes the then Chinese defense minister from 2 decades ago, General Qi Houqian, as talking about Deng Xiaoping's ambition to have a biological warfare capability for eliminating the U.S. population as part of a strategy, a grand design, a plan to dominate the earth, if you will, that envisioned a second China on American soil. I don't know if you can comment on the accuracy of that report or whether it's simply consistent more generally with what you've learned about this very dangerous program of China's, but I think you're absolutely right. We've got to get to the bottom of this and reckon with the fact that, if nothing else, Steve Mosher, the Chinese have learned from this whole episode how lethal biological warfare could be against a society like ours.
Yeah, and let me give you a more recent quote, the quote from Qi Houqian, of course, come 20 years ago. But in 2017, 3 years ago, the president of the National Defense University, a four-star general, wrote a book called The New High Ground, in which he talked about bioweapons being the new high ground, and the acme of an effective bioweapon would be a bioweapon that targeted certain ethnicities. So we know they have a bioweapon program in place. We know they're intending to use it if they can to displace us as the dominant power on the earth. And of course, we know they have absolute disregard for human life. I mean, that's why they're sending their people back to the factories now when they're still grappling with the epidemic. Will they let people, workers, die in order to get the steel plants and the other factories in China back online? Of course they will. Of course they will. So this is what's going on in China.
Yeah, and as you say, Steve, this isn't speculation. This is the track record of the Chinese Communist Party. And in terms of displacing us, you know, as the dominant power of the world, that's a pretty scary proposition, given the nature of the regime and how they would handle the world if they really ran it. But displacing us as a people is an even more appalling prospect. And if that were what's come about here, or certainly advancing that agenda, whether by accident or by design, this constitutes the arguably one of the most egregious crimes against humanity of all time, I would suggest.
Yeah, I believe that the Communist Party is responsible for the origin and the spread of the epidemic. I believe that it has become a form of biological warfare on humanity for them, that they, of course, do not care that hundreds of thousands of their own people. I mean, look, the numbers that come out of China are all fabrications. In Wuhan alone, we believe 40 or 50,000 people died, not the 2,000 that the regime admits. We know there are still deaths throughout China, but that doesn't matter, because that is eclipsed by the larger goal of the party to achieve world dominion. And they're playing this for all their might now to work for exactly that end. So we can't take our eye off the ball. We have a pandemic to deal with now, but the reckoning has to start now. We can't wait until this is all over. to call China to account. We need to be calling China to account right now. We need to be bringing the nations of the world into an anti-China alliance to make them pay a heavy price for what they have done, not just to America, but to the entire world.
Steve Mosher, well said, of course, as always, and very much, I believe, consistent with both the historical experience with the Chinese Communist Party and the present danger it poses to us. And we're again so grateful to you for your work with the Committee on the Present Danger China, which is trying to elevate awareness, certainly easier to do today than it was when we started it about a year ago. But your leadership, your vision, your clarity about the challenge that we're facing and what we must do about it is deeply appreciated. Thank you for sharing it with us today. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Michael Waller about some of the steps the Chinese Communist Party is taking to dominate the world and what we must do, again, to counter it, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by one of our distinguished colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. He is a senior analyst for strategy by the name of Dr. J. Michael Waller. He has done extraordinary things over a long period of time. First, as a very young man, helping President Reagan in the fight against the Contras in Latin America. He has been intimately involved in the years since in most of the most important public policy fights we've had, first with the Soviet Union, then with Russia, now with China. He's a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China and a very valued colleague and friend. Mike Waller, it's good to have you back. Welcome. I wanted to sort of pick up where we just left off with Steve Mosher. He established fairly clearly the Chinese Communist Party's responsibility for the present pandemic and all that is flowing from it, and made a very powerful argument, I think, for holding them accountable for it and ensuring that there are costs to them for doing it. You wrote recently about some similar thoughts that were expressed by our distinguished Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Remind us what the Secretary has said on the subject of the CCP's culpability for a virus that I think properly should bear its name.
Oh, well, Secretary Pompeo has done an amazing job. I was slow to warm up to him and some of his policies, but I really think he has cemented his place in history right now as the first Secretary of State in our history to go after the Chinese Communist Party by name and to hold them responsible as an institution for its really crimes against America and the rest of the world. But also to go after, on a more operational basis, Chinese Communist Party disinformation and propaganda. I mean, even Ronald Reagan, where you'd remember, he had to force the State Department and his Secretaries of State to go after Soviet propaganda. Pompeo's taking a lead on this for the Trump administration, and it's really historic.
It's very encouraging, and it kind of plays into what I think is a short form of how to characterize this problem. China lied. People died. And holding them accountable is where all of this, I think, has to start. The World Health Organization, Mike, you've given some thought to the role that this outfit, this nominal international organization that has the interests of the whole world in mind, how it's actually operating. Just tell us quickly about that.
Oh, well, the World Health Organization, yes, it's a UN agency. And like most things at the UN, our adversaries take control of them, and we neglect them, but we provide the most funding for them. And so the same is true with the World Health Organization. It's not so much a health entity as it is a political body that's pretty much controlled now by Communist China. They pay 0.25% of the World Health Organization budget, yet they control it.
And have done so with great benefit to their campaign to avoid responsibility for what they've done to compound the dangers of this disease and otherwise, you know, sort of exploit their role as now the savior of the world. And that brings me to calling attention to something that you've done, Mike, that I think is really important, a timeline of the Chinese Communist Party's conduct and specifically its propaganda operations. As you say, they've been militarized, or I would say weaponized, for the purposes of advancing the party's interest at our expense. Give us a quick tour of what you have documented. People can find it at communistpropaganda.com, as I understand it, right?
Right. That goes straight to our Center for Security Policy website, and it's so you go to communistpropaganda.com or the center's website to the Wuhan virus tab. Both take you to the same place, and it traces the outbreak of the virus in last November of last year, and then the Chinese Communist Party's responses to repress and lie and disinform, and ultimately, when it got out of their control, how they changed their propaganda line to make, they waited 3 weeks so they could make Xi Jinping look like a hero. He was in hiding for 3 weeks until they could figure out how to make him look good. And then they made him look like a hero with these big decisive plans. And of course, they're all planned out in advance. So they waited weeks for people to die off for before doing anything to contain this virus. And it was really to benefit Xi Jinping's power. And so this timeline tracks all that using official Chinese Communist Party sources that give the party line. These are the authoritative journals that tell everyone else, this is the party line, and this is what you should say. These are the themes we want you to say in Chinese and in English. And then it traces U.S. policy and how, from the beginning, the Trump administration was trying to help China deal with this, and the China said, back off. Trump was giving uncharacteristically strong diplomatic support of the Chinese government to cope with this. And then the Chinese government came out and started accusing the United States of being behind the virus, that the military, American military, planted the virus. Going to Lyndon LaRouche websites to pick up conspiracy theory stories and then churn it out as allegations on Twitter, which then become repeated around the world. So it goes all the way up to that, to the point where, as you said, the Chinese Communist Party weaponized this disinformation by now having their military, the People's Liberation Army, actually promoting this as a military tool to use against us. So it's an astonishing thing to track. And then you track how people at CNN pick up these themes and certain politicians pick up these themes, and then how the Chinese communists go back and they take what American politicians say, and then they use that in their own propaganda to show, see, everyone says we're right and that Donald Trump is the bad guy.
Another theme of the Chinese propaganda, Mike, in addition to trying to lay off the blame on our military for introducing this disease in China, has been, well, I call it communism is a cure for COVID-19. It's the idea that their brand of totalitarianism and the kind of heavy-handed restrictions of their people actually broke the back of this disease. When you couple that with their fraudulent data and what they're doing now to, you know, compel their people to go to work under perhaps very dangerous conditions, it's sinister in the extreme, as Steve Mosher was pointing out, but it's not surprising given the nature of this regime. And your study is informed, of course, by deep work on and research about Soviet propaganda. Compare and contrast real quickly.
The Soviet propaganda model, the actual machinery, was by the Soviet Communist Party itself, not the Soviet states. And the Chinese Communist Party is modeled after that. So even though the Cold War is over, China maintained that same structure and those same processes. So if you know the old Soviet propaganda system, you don't even have to speak Chinese to understand the Chinese propaganda system. It works very, very, very similarly. So they have a central propaganda department that the party has at the top, where the line is set. And then their controlled agents and their assets and, say, think tanks in Washington that take their money and journalists who sympathize and others will then follow that, and then they end up knowing what to say. So if you follow our Center for Security Policy timeline, you'll see how the party sets the line in the official publications that we link to, and then how American groups and politicians and journalists and think tanks end up repeating that party line.
Yeah, and do so in a way that is effectively political warfare against our own country and government and interests on behalf of a foreign government's interests and agendas. And this is really stunning, and why I think this timeline is such an important contribution, Mike, to our understanding of the more general character of the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to us. Again, the purpose of our Committee on the Present Danger China is to try to expose this, and you are doing handsomely in that regard. Mike, one last piece of this, which I think is also pretty insidious, is that of late, the Chinese Communist Party propaganda line has been that China is the cavalry coming to the rescue of the world, bringing masks and test kits and other help to medical professionals to save those who are now afflicted by this disease. What is the truth with respect to all of that, Mike? And why are they making such a point of trying to promote this particular line?
Oh, that's a great point, because the Xi Jinping regime looks like it's got a lot of cracks in it right now. Cracks at the top and cracks from the bottom, where people are seeing, you know, they always knew, but they're really seeing how the party is lying to them, and they don't even care what happens to the people. So what the Chinese party has done to show that it's not a problem, because it was getting even its friends around the world very upset for being responsible, they flipped it to say, no, we didn't stall for 2 months. You people have to understand, we bought the rest of the world 2 months' time to get ready to fight the pandemic. They've repeated this line over and over and over, and then they're sending shipments with, as almost the only manufacturers in the world of a lot of this gear that's necessary to protect against such a virus. They're saying, see how gracious we are providing this to the world. Well, when you look at it, most of these countries are paying cash for these products. But and in the Chinese propaganda publications, they use the word aid and sales interchangeably. But even the Russians are buying it from the Chinese, but they're fumigating it publicly, unlike the rest of the recipients.
And a number of the recipients have pointed out that whether the stuff is contaminated or whether it's simply defective, it isn't worth what they're paying for it, that's for sure. All of this is to say, Mike Waller, that we're dealing with an odious communist system seeking to impose its totalitarian form of government on the rest of us. And they have found ways to use this virus, and as we talked about with Steve Mosier, perhaps by design, perhaps by accident or convenience, taking advantage of the opportunity to use the pandemic as a new tool in this campaign for global dominance. And we must resist it at every turn. We appreciate, Mike, your vision and clarity on that subject and so much else, and the work you're doing at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Hans von Spakovsky about the election that is supposed to be held this year. You may have forgotten about it, but it's still in the works, we think. And what are the efforts being made to try to hijack it? That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to the great Hans von Spakovsky, a man whose name is properly reduced to an acronym, HVS, on our program. He has been an extraordinary resource for us and so many others with respect to a number of topics, drawing on his long experience both in government and in the think tank business, notably in his present role as the senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. But he also served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights a while back, and is a former member of the Federal Election Commission, as well as a best-selling author on subjects of various topics, but particularly with a focus on election fraud. Notably, a book he co-authored with John Fund entitled Who's Counting How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. HVS, it's good to have you back in the house, virtually at least. Welcome. I wanted to talk with you, Hans, about your particular specialization in terms of voting integrity at a moment when, while it's not much in the news anymore, this is supposed to be an election year. I trust it will be in the end. But there are lots of challenges to it, not least of which is all of the social distancing and contending in other ways with the pandemic. Give us sort of an overview of how you see the election of 2020 shaping up at the moment.
Well, you know, the chief problem right now is the primaries. More than a dozen states have delayed or put off the date of their primaries. Many of them are thinking of switching to, rather than having polling places open where you can vote in person, of having all-mail elections where people use absentee ballots to vote. And the key issue there is there are ways to do that and ways not to do it. And the ways not to do it were outlined in the coronavirus bill that Nancy Pelosi tried to get through Congress. They had all these provisions there that would have overridden state laws governing absentee ballots and made it easier to cheat and easier to manipulate election results. And those are the ways it shouldn't be done. And the reason for this is simple. You know, absentee ballots are the tools of choice of people who want to steal elections. And, you know, they're ballots that are voted outside the supervision of election officials. So it's easy for voters to be intimidated, for their ballots to be stolen, for ballots to be fraudulently forged or altered. And that's why we have to be very careful with this. I don't think, Frank, this is going to be a problem in the November 3rd election, because I think, look, even the worst predictions of the coronavirus are that we will have peaked by then. And I think people will be back at work, back at school, and back in polling places voting.
Well, please God, there's some talk about a second phase of this horror. But Hans, I just want to ask you to drill down a little bit on that. Nancy Pelosi was widely, and I think properly, vilified for what she was trying to accomplish on a whole host of leftist Green New Deal and other pork barrel agendas in the context of this emergency funding for the coronavirus pandemic. This arguably was the single most sinister of her various gambits, though, wasn't it? And to the extent that it's sort of a playbook for how the left would like to steal elections in the future, how much have they gotten away with, if not in federal legislation, in trying to get similar kinds of arrangements put into place at the state level, and thereby, you know, perhaps already corrupting or otherwise affecting at least the primaries coming up?
Well, to give you an example, 2 years ago, California legalized vote harvesting, and that was a provision in the federal bill. It would have mandated the state to allow vote harvesting. And what that means is, look, in states like North Carolina, you can hand deliver your absentee ballot, you can mail it back, or a member of your family can hand deliver it to election officials. In states like California that now allow vote harvesting, anybody can pick up your completed ballot and deliver it to election officials. That means that ballots can end up in the hands of candidates, political party officials, political guns for hire, political consultants, all of whom have a stake in the outcome of the election. And for anybody who thinks that's not a bad idea, all you have to do is look at 2018. There was one contested congressional race in the country, North Carolina, 9. The election there was overturned. Why? Because North Carolina actually bans vote harvesting, and yet a political consultant there went around collecting absentee ballots from voters, and the evidence showed that ballots were changed, signatures were forged, and some ballots were picked up before they'd even been voted. Of course, by the time they got to election officials, they had been voted. And that is the problem with vote harvesting. And yet she wanted to make that legal all over. She also would have banned all state requirements that there be witness signatures or notarization of absentee ballots, and would have prohibited any kind of ID requirement for absentee ballots, something that states like Wisconsin and Alabama have. And then just the final thing very quickly is, look, in every state you can vote an absentee ballot if you can't make it to the polls or you're ill. But those ballots aren't processed and counted until the end of election day, along with all the votes people have cast on election day. And the reason for that is obvious. you don't want to start counting early, because if those results are leaked, then people who haven't voted yet may be deterred from voting because the candidate that they want to pick, they see, is losing. Or if it's leaked to candidates and political parties, they may change what they're doing to try to change the outcome of the election. Her bill would require states to start counting ballots 2 weeks before Election Day, which is just crazy, but it would give an opportunity to manipulate election results.
Which is obviously the sort of leitmotif of this whole program. Hans, just quickly come back to this voter ID business, because we've talked about it before, and it seems just such common sense. And yet, one of the things that the left has seemingly established, despite, I believe, a Supreme Court ruling permitting voter IDs, is kind of this attack on such a practice as something that is designed to suppress the minority voting turnout. And just what is the historical experience here, and what might be the consequence of eliminating, you know, states' latitude to impose such requirements?
Well, first of all, we know that it is a completely false claim that is made by the left that voter ID suppresses votes. We've got 10 years worth of turnout data from states like Georgia and Indiana who've had a photo ID requirement in place since the 2008 election. And that data clearly shows it does not prevent people from voting, including minority voters, whether they're Black or white, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. It doesn't suppress votes, doesn't keep people out of the polls. That's because, look, you and I know, for the average American, unlike the elitists in places like New York and Washington, you need an ID every day for so many things that you do. And Americans overwhelmingly have ID. So then suppress votes at all. But it's a way of preventing the kind of things that we have seen happen just very quickly. Alabama, for example, they passed a voter ID law that applies to both in-person voting and absentee balloting. Why? Because they've had numerous absentee ballot fraud cases in Alabama. And while an ID requirement can't completely stop it, it's very easy to forge a signature and send in a fraudulent absentee ballot. It's a lot tougher to be able to get a photocopy of the photo ID of that registered voter to send in with it, which is what you're supposed to do in Alabama. So it makes it tougher to commit voter fraud.
Which should be what we're all about, voting being the most solemn responsibility, arguably, of citizenship, and ensuring that it's just citizens that are voting and that they're only voting once and they're voting in the place that they're supposed to vote should be a no-brainer and something that all Americans would support. And it's very troubling that the left, the Democrats more generally, seem to be so adamantly opposed to that. We appreciate your leadership, Hans von Spakovsky, in making the case for voter integrity, voting integrity, I should say. And also, of course, hats off to Republicans in the Senate and House who ultimately prevailed in blocking Nancy Pelosi's agenda, at least for the moment. I know you'll be keeping your eye on it. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with more Hans von Spakovsky on the coronavirus and voting and what we need to do to ensure that the Republic remains on sound footing in both regards. God bless you, my friend. Stay well. I hope that we'll have a chance to talk with the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.